Serial Sisters podcast.
Welcome, welcome. This is Sister Cassie.
And this is Sister Gina. For the final time, we're back for our grand finale.
The finale.
I'm kind of sad about this.
Me too. The end of an era.
The end of an era. Truly is. And now we will never talk to each other again.
Ever. Really. I'm deleting your number.
I have no excuse to ever speak to you again. But I said this has been a rough week, but, like, I guess we didn't have any, like, major historical event besides, like, Wall Street being all effed up.
Well, that's what I was like, and that happened on a Wednesday, too. It was, what did they say? It goes, insurrection, impeachment, inauguration, investment.
Yeah, I think that, I said, was that a TikTok you saw? Because I think I saw the same one.
Yeah, it's like, can't wait for next Wednesday.
Well, I was laughing because I'm like, ugh, I've been like debate, like weirdly in my head, I'm like, should I invest in stock for the past like 3 months? And then I was watching CNN the other night and they like interviewed someone's mom who like bought stock and he apparently like got like $20,000 off like his GameStop stock and like paid off his student loans. And I was like, ugh, I would love to do that, but like I'm too terrified of like the risk and like knowing my luck, I would like invest $10 and then end up with like $60,000 of debt. Ugh. I'm like, I just need someone. I don't trust stock market people though because of like every stock market movie you've ever seen. I feel like they're just all scammers. But I would like want to like give like $20 to someone and be like, invest this where you think it'll make money. So I don't know what's going on with Britney Spears again, if we want to talk. Apparently, have you seen, like, there's, like, a documentary coming out?
Ooh.
About, like, the whole Free Britney situation? Oh, what's it called? It's
probably called Free Britney.
No, it's not. It's, like, creating something.
Creating the Free Britney movement.
No, it's not. Nothing with Free Britney is in the title. But apparently, it, like, interviews, like, past managers or something. Okay, it's called Framing Britney Spears.
It doesn't have Britney in the title.
No, I said it doesn't have Free Britney in the title.
Oh.
It premieres February 5th on Hulu.
Oh, it's very soon. I'll have to watch that.
Okay, so it says the new feature-length documentary by the New York Times captures what the public might not know about the nature of Britney's conservatorship and her court battle with her father over who should control her estate. And it interviews key insiders, including a lifelong family friend who traveled alongside Britney for much of her career, the marketing executive who originally created her image, a lawyer currently working on her conservatorship, and the lawyer she tried to hire in the early days of her conservatorship to challenge her father.
It's all a very interesting thing.
She's been completely, like, screwed over, in my opinion. And, like,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about it in past episodes, but just, like, the Instagram videos she's been posting.
I can't watch them.
I can't either. Like, I feel, like, so bad because I'm just, like, she just seems like such a shell.
Yeah.
Of a person. You know what I mean? Like, she doesn't seem... Well, I know I've read stuff before that, like, she's on some kind of, like, medication.
Yeah, she looks like she's just, like, stuck.
That, like, messes with her.
Yeah, she just looks like she's stuck in this, like, never-ending circle of sameness because all her the videos, the only thing that changes is the song.
It's the same choreography, like, every time.
She's doing the exact same thing. She's wearing, like, the exact same outfits every time. Her hair looks the same. Her makeup looks, like, I'm like, I don't know.
And then she'll post, like, 6 pictures. It's all the same selfie with different filters. And then she'll be like, this is not edited at all. Swipe for the original. And it's just, like, her under a tree.
I'm worried for her.
So, me too. Also, on kind of like a true crime thing. You know how that like Richard Ramirez documentary came out?
The what one?
Like the Night Stalker.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, yeah. I don't understand, because now there's all these people again. Like when the Ted Bundy documentaries came out, all these people are like, oh my God, Richard Ramirez is so hot. I'm like, what is wrong with you in the brain?
Yeah.
That you're like romanticizing the serial killer. I don't understand it.
Yeah, I saw some stuff about that. People were like, well, it's not, like, the acts that we like. It's the like it's the person, but, like, his features. And I'm like, no. No.
Yeah. No. Stop. He was just misunderstood. Like, he literally murdered people. I've been misunderstood, and I haven't killed people. Like, let's get into the final episode of the Serial Sisters podcast. And who knows? Maybe we'll come back for, like, a special episode 6 months down the line. Who knows? Never say never. But for now, let's get into the final episode of the Serial Sisters podcast. We're doing unsolved murders / cases of the 1980s. Would you like to go first for the final time? I don't know why I'm like, I feel like this is like the Princess Diaries when they're like, the sparrow comes down the whatever for the final time. Or the sparrow is,
or the eagle is the eagle is flying for the final time.
Was that what it was? The eagle's flying?
I don't know. It was some big bird, I think.
Something like that. Big bird.
The pigeon is flying for the final time. Down Sesame
Street for the final time.
The first 1980s unsolved case that I'm going to be talking about is the disappearance of Ed Baker.
Okay.
Now, I couldn't find any information on him as a kid or really any information on his life before this.
Okay.
So basically, I'm just going to tell the story. It's pretty short, but it's interesting. So, Ed Baker was a wealthy Texas millionaire. Making his fortune from oil, he founded one of the fastest growing businesses in the United States with his wife, Mary Walker. Ed promoted, quote, oil well exploration, which prospered and resulted in him developing a type of midlife crisis. So in March of 1984, Ed divorced his wife, Mary, after 10 years of marriage. He then spent his time gambling, got a couple facelifts, and bought a Jaguar car. God.
The facelifts are already not a good sign.
Like, I'm like, hey, midlife crisis.
Especially in the 80s, facelifts are not a good sign.
Mm-hmm. Like, you can just picture the type of person he looks like.
Oh, gosh.
You know? So just 6 months after his divorce from his first wife, Mary, in September of 1984, Ed married Karen Walbridge, but their marriage only lasted 11 months. Then Ed gets right back to it, and not even 2 months after his second divorce, he marries Sandra Hoff, who happened to be one of his employees from his business. So after his third marriage to Sandra, Ed's business started to crumble and he began spending his investors' money to support his lifestyle, which is a big no-no. His attorney at the time, Ward Bussey, warned him that if he continued to use his investors' money for personal use, he could face jail time. By October of 1985, Ed's investors were demanding money. Ed's company was on the verge of bankruptcy and he needed to act fast. He set up a cash bailout for what was considered a suspicious source. Ed then had his private investigator look into where the money was coming from, and it was found to have connections to the mafia. So it's like Ed gets this divorce and then he's going through this midlife crisis. He is buying all these extravagant things, getting facelifts, marrying everybody and their brother. Yeah. And then his business is tanking all at the same time. And then he's like, oh, and I'm involved with the mafia. This is fun.
You know, I will give him this. He knows how to live an interesting life.
So after he finds out about the connection to the mafia, things only get worse for him after that. On November 6th, 1985, around 7:30 p.m., Ed showed up at his first ex-wife Mary's home. He was allegedly in emotional disarray and stated that he thought, quote, someone was after him. He also told Mary that he had received death threats in letters at work and two phone calls where the caller stated, quote, this is your day to die. Mary told Ed to contact the police, obviously, but Ed said the police couldn't help him, so he just left.
Sounds like a mafia thing. I don't know
what he thought. Well, I'm like, what did you think your first ex-wife was going to do for
you? Right.
Like, she's like, you divorced me, you left me, go to the police. And he's like, no. And then just leaves.
Like, if my ex ever came back and like was like, hey, I think someone's after me, I'd be like, you're on your own, buddy. Get away.
Yeah, I'd be like, I don't care. Cool. You weren't there for me, so now I'm not there for you. Like,
why would I care?
So after Ed visited Mary, he sent his wife Sandra to Austin, Texas as a precaution for her safety and then hold himself up at his home. Wait,
he has another wife again and he's going to his ex-wife for help?
Yeah, that's why I was like, I don't know what he thought he was going to get out of that. Yeah. Ed also only communicated with his wife Sandra once by phone, 1 hour after midnight. And when he spoke to her, he told her that he had received another threatening phone call. So just 2 days later, after he had sent Sandra to Austin, on November 8th, 1985, Ed's Jaguar was found burning 20 miles outside of Houston, Texas, with a charred body inside. No. The body found in the car was so disfigured, no one was able to tell who it was at first. After forensic analysis, it was confirmed to be Ed's body. A burnt .32 caliber revolver was found on the floor of the car as well. In the firing pin of the revolver, there was an indentation which indicates that one shot had been fired. The other five shell casings had exploded from the heat of the fire, and 3 1-gallon gas cans were found in and around the car. So as the police were doing their investigation, not only did they find a burning vehicle with a body in it, they had another big shot. Just a few hundred feet from the car, investigators found another body.
Okay.
It was a young man in his early 20s that was handcuffed. He had been beaten to death. But after an investigation into that body, it was found out that it was completely unrelated to Ed's case. And it had been, the body had been involved in a drug deal.
But it was like okay.
Yeah, it was like right in the same area. Like,
oh, I thought you said it was like in the same car. And I was like, how is it in the car? But never.
No.
I got you now.
It wasn't, not in the car, but still super weird. So the same day that Ed's body was found in the car, his attorney, Ward Bussey, received a letter at his office. And the letter said, "Dear Ward, if you are reading this letter, it means I am dead. I've had some threats in my life. You've been a good friend to me. Take care of Sandy and the kids." Enclosed in the letter Ward received, Ed included another letter to be delivered to his wife Sandra and his children. His wife Sandra believes that Ed was the victim of a mafia hit. However, the police believe that his death was suicide. Police thought this because shortly before Ed's death, he had called his life insurance agents and asked them specifically if his policies would cover in the event of a suicide. Only one of his policies, valued at nearly $500,000, would not. Investigators believe that Ed had shot himself in his car and had an accomplice set fire to it in order to make it look as if it was a homicide. His wife, Sandra, refused to believe that her husband would kill himself, so she ended up hiring an independent investigator who believes that someone was actually hired to kill Ed. However, the attorney, Ward Bussey, disagreed with that assessment, saying based on the letter he had received, he believed that Ed had planned on killing himself. Ward believed that Ed committed suicide so that he would not have to go to jail for his crimes. But after an arson investigator looked over the car, they said Ed would not have been able to set fire to his car and himself and still be able to commit suicide in the car.
Yeah, because, sorry, was the cause of death, like, from the fire? Or was it, like, he shot himself and then the car was on fire?
That's where they don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, there's, like, a lot of unanswered questions because they have, like, all the pieces, but they're like, how did this... Yeah. Happened? Did he have someone come do this for him? Was he able to pull it off by himself? Did somebody do this to him? It was so disfigured that they didn't know.
Okay.
So one of the investigators on the case, Bob Gale, said he had reasons to believe the man found in the car was not Ed, but rather someone else allowing Ed to fake his death and disappear. Investigator Gale believes Ed fled to an unknown location, possibly somewhere in the Caribbean, to live on funds embezzled from his investors. So far, no one has answers as to what happened that night. There are no suspects. There's no evidence beyond what they found. And the case has been unsolved for 36 years. And that's the story of the disappearance of Ed Baker. And it's not classified as murder or suicide or anything because
that one is,
they don't know.
That one's so interesting because I feel like it could totally be like, it could go either way. Because, like, on the one hand, I'm like, I would totally find it plausible for him to fake his death with all the shit he was, like, running from. But on the other hand, I also would find it totally plausible if someone was, like, wanting to kill him, wanting to, like, make the scene so weird that people didn't know if it was murder or not, you know?
Yeah, I could also see him being a coward and running from his problems and offing himself.
Yeah.
Like, I'm wondering if it could have been a situation where he puts gas all over himself, all over the car, gets into the driver's seat, has a gun in one hand and a match in another, lights the match, and then shoots
himself. That's what I was thinking. But then if the arson or whoever is saying that he wouldn't have had time to, like, start the car on fire and then shoot himself. That reminds me of a Forensic Files where this guy tried to, him and his wife, like, his body was found in his car, had been lit on fire. And I don't remember exactly what it was, but, like, it ended up coming out that, like, the body in the car was, like, an old woman who had, like, recently died and had been, like, dug up from a cemetery. And then, like, him and his wife, like, were in on it together for, like, insurance money.
I feel like that's such a common thing. Like,
I know, it's
people
so...
People are always going, doing...
Life,
you know,
insurance fraud is so unoriginal to me. Like, what... Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess the cases that have worked, you wouldn't know. But, like, I just... I feel like so... Like, I feel like almost every... Like, literally 95% of Forensic Files episodes, too, and there's probably 1,000 of them, are, like, life insurance policy cases. Anywho. My first unsolved case... I feel like you're going to find pretty interesting. At least I hope you do. So this is the unsolved murder of Diane Fossey. So Diane Fossey was born on January 16th, 1932 in San Francisco, California, to Catherine and George E. Fossey. So the first few years of her life were fairly uneventful. However, around age 5, her parents separated. So after her parents separated, her mom, Catherine, remarried a businessman named Richard Price. And while her father really tried hard to maintain a relationship with her, her mother really kind of fought him on it and, like, essentially did not really support the two of them having a relationship. So eventually they lost contact with each other. And then, unfortunately, Diane did not have a solid relationship with her stepfather, Richard. In fact, like, it kind of seems like he really didn't want anything to do with her. He really did not look at her as his child and didn't seem to, like, even, like, he didn't even seem to really, like, treat her as a member of the family. Like, for example, he wouldn't let her sit at the dinner table with him and her mom, which is, like, so weird. Like, what is she, maybe 7 or something? And you're like, no, like, we're eating dinner. You can't eat with us. Literally Mean Girls, like, you can't sit with us. And then he also was, like, an extremely strict disciplinarian, and he really, like, would not offer her any kind of emotional support. So struggles in her home life initially helped to bridge Diane's connection to animals. And this connection began simply with a pet goldfish, then by riding horses, and she eventually started showing, like, really exceptional equestrian skills. So Diane graduated from Lowell High School in 1950. And after strong urgence, like, kind of, or strong encouragement, I guess, from her stepfather, Richard, she enrolled as a business major at the College of Marin, located in her hometown of San Francisco. So after completing her freshman year, she spent the summer on a ranch in Montana. And this was where, upon a lot of self-reflection and solitude, Diane realized her true passion and love for animals. Because of this, and preparing for her sophomore year, she transferred to the University of California, Davis, where she enrolled in pre-veterinary courses. And this greatly upset her mom and stepdad, more so her stepfather. So after this, they stopped providing any kind of financial assistance. So Diane fully supported herself through school. Throughout her education, she worked as a department store clerk, a machinist, and various laboratory work. So throughout her life, she had shown extreme and promising academic talent, but in the second year of her program at UC Davis, she really struggled with chemistry and physics, leading her to failing the semester. So because of this, she transferred to San Jose State College, where she joined the Kappa Alpha Theta sorority. She graduated in 1954 with a bachelor's degree in occupational therapy. After graduating, she interned at multiple California hospitals, where she primarily worked with tuberculosis patients. In 1955, she moved to Louisville, Kentucky, where she was hired at the Cosair Crippled Children's Hospital, and she often worked with autistic children. So Diane worked really well with the children, and she was, like, pretty successful in her role, and she struck up a friendship with a coworker, Mary White Henry, who was the wife of one of the doctors at the hospital, Michael Henry. So the Henrys resided on a farm where they housed various kinds of livestock as well as horses. Diane grew close with the Henry family and began to spend more and more time on their farm. She really enjoyed her time there. She loved the strong family atmosphere they had, and she loved being able to spend time with horses again. So the Henrys eventually invited her to join them on a tour in Africa, but she was not able to join them because she didn't have the money. In September of 1963, she took out her entire life savings and left for a 7-week trip to Africa. She touched down in Nairobi, Kenya. Not long after she arrived, she met actor William Holden, who was best known for his role in the film Sunset Boulevard, which is just like a random detail. But this chance meeting is super notable because William Holden introduced Diane to John Alexander, who would be her guide for the next 7 weeks as they traveled across Kenya, Tanzania, the Congo, and Rhodesia. Alexander brought her across notable wildlife hotspots throughout Africa, including the famed Olduvai Gorge, I hope that's how you say it, which is considered to be one of the most important paleoanthropological sites in the world, which is where she met Lewis and Mary Leakey, who are British paleoanthropologists, where through their work made at the gorge, they made significant discoveries relating to human evolution. What is perhaps most significant about this interaction was that she spoke with Lewis Leakey about research work on apes. After this conversation, Diane and Alexander camped alongside wildlife photographers John and Alan Root. During this expedition, Diane experienced her first encounter with wild gorillas, and she was completely awestruck. What I like about this case is that I can tell you have no idea where this is going.
No, I don't.
So her trip came to a close, and she returned back to Louisville. Once back in the States, she published 3 pieces in the Courier Journal on her experiences in Africa. A few years later, Lewis Leakey was on a nationwide speaking tour, which included a stop in Louisville. Diane, along with copies of her published articles, reconnected at the event with him. The two spoke about the studies Jane Goodall had been doing with chimpanzees in Tanzania, and the conversation turned Leakey to suggesting that Diane do the same kind of long-term study, but with gorillas. So after this conversation, Lewis Leakey helped Diane secure funding for a long-term research study. Diane spent the next 8 months preparing her visa, studying Swahili and primatology, and preparing to relocate to Africa. So in December of 1966, Diane landed in Nairobi, and before she headed into the Congo, she stopped by the Gombe Stream Research Center, where she met with Jane Goodall to learn and discuss Goodall's research methods from her study of chimpanzees. So after the meeting with Jane Goodall, Diane's research work began. In January of 1967, she began her studies in Kabara in the Virunga Mountains, and photographer Alan Root accompanied her and was like kind of her right-hand man, and he really helped like teach and assist her with gorilla tracking. So she worked to identify various groups in her study area, and she discovered that she could attract and gain trust with the gorillas by mimicking their actions and grunting sounds. But with political tensions high in the area at the time, Diane was forced to relocate her research studies. So in the fall of 1967, she moved to a rainforest campsite located in the Ruhengeri province, which was situated between 2 volcanoes, Mount Karasimbi and Mount Bisoke. I hope that's how you say it. Here she founded the Karasoke Research Center. So the gorillas in this area were a little harder for her to develop trust with because they were human interaction to them mostly consisted of like poachers and hunters. But she had to work a little harder, but she did develop trust with them. And she later explained, quote, "I'm an inhibited persona and I felt that the gorillas were someone inhibited as well. So I imitated their natural, normal behavior like feeding, munching on celery stalks, or scratching myself." Through her study, Diane was able to identify many distinctions within like gorilla mating, their social relationships, their diets, vocalization, differentiations, and then how like the packs operated within like hierarchies. So National Geographic began contributing to her funding, and in 1970, they put her on the cover of the National Geographic magazine, which brought enormous attention to her studies. So as she continued her studies throughout the 1970s, she had also continued her higher education studies as well, which included earning her PhD in zoology from Cambridge University in England. Throughout the decade, she became viewed as the world expert when it came to the physiology and behavior of mountain gorillas, and in the early 1980s, she was even hired by Cornell University as a professor. Now, while she was like really successful and highly praised for her work, that doesn't mean she didn't make a few enemies along the way. Poaching was illegal and had been since the 1920s, but that didn't stop people from hunting gorillas. And they would often, like, really only want the babies, but obviously parents and other, like, adult gorillas within their packs would be very protective, and they would literally fight to the death to protect the young. So that would result in a lot more gorillas dying. And Diane had seen the aftermath of this happening on quite a few occasions. So using some of her research funds, she paid to have, like, some of her staff patrol the mountains and destroy traps that poachers had left. And they actually ended up destroying almost 1,000 traps in the span of, like, 4 months or something. So she also assisted authorities in arresting quite a few poachers who got handed, like, really long-term prison sentences. The start of the 1960s, just for some perspective here, at the start of the 1960s, the population of mountain gorillas was 475. By the 1980s, that number dropped to 254. So these gorillas were, like, still remain extremely endangered. I think, like, from what I read, like, now, and she and Diane's, like, research and anti-poaching efforts, like, helped contribute to this. But I think from what I read, maybe it was, like, 2015 or something, the population was, like, in the 800s now. But, like, they're still considered, like, super endangered, obviously. So she also had issues with situations where zoos were trying to capture infant gorillas. And what would happen, though, they would end up killing adult gorillas in the process. And then the young gorillas ended up dying in captivity, which really upset her to see, and she tried really hard to prevent it from happening. The biggest issue she kept running into was local poachers that kept invading her research area and were also actively hunting in the vicinity just outside her research area. So a lot of these tensions came to a head on New Year's Eve in 1977. Diane's favorite gorilla, whom she named Digit, was viciously killed by poachers in her study area. Digit had been struck by 5 spears, decapitated, and then his hands were cut off so that they could be sold as ashtrays.
Oh my god, I hate people.
Digit was only 12 years old, which African gorillas typically have a lifespan of 35 years. So Diane was obviously very distraught and affected by this, and she later said that the ordeal was the saddest moment in her entire life. And she was said to have gone in, like, a really, really deep depression after this. So eventually her and her research group were able to track down and identify 3 of the 6 poachers. And the 3 that were able to be identified received really hefty prison sentences. So this was where she kind of, like, started focusing. She was still focusing on research, but, like, her kind of, like, primary focus turned to anti-poaching efforts. And her team got really aggressive in their approach. So they would cut down traps, like, almost immediately after they would set. They would capture the poachers and even light their campsites on fire at times. And one account reported that Diane allegedly captured one poacher and then, like, beat his private region with stinging nettles, which is, like, a thorny plant. And then she also was known to pretend to be a witch who practiced black magic to, like, scare away the poachers. And then she also allegedly kidnapped a poacher's kid and then held him for ransom. So it got, like, real intense. But, like, I'm not gonna lie, I'm, like, still on her side. It's like, fuck you, like, gorilla poachers. Leave them be. But, like, also on that note, I guess, like, some people kind of felt like she got, like, really racist, like, basically against, like, the local, like, Rwandan people. And it was basically, like, every Rwanda person she, like, viewed as, like, an enemy. And, like, so, like, obviously I don't agree with that. But, like, also this is kind of just, like, unvetted sources. So, I mean, who really knows? But so in 1985, Diane released her memoir titled Gorillas in the Mist. The book covers her research years in the mountains of Africa and also touches on the importance of united conservation efforts. The book was an enormous success and helped to bring attention to the research, conservation, and anti-poaching work being done at Karasoki. The book's rights were sold and a movie of the same name would be released in 1988 that starred Sigourney Weaver as Diane Fossey. On the morning of December 27, 1985, Diane Fossey was found murdered in the bedroom of her cabin in the Virunga Mountains. Her body was found face up in the bed. She had been bludgeoned to death, and her face had been split from what appeared to be a machete. Her bedroom had been ransacked, furniture was thrown over, there were bloodstains on the carpet, and there was broken glass all over. About 7 feet from her bed, there had been a hole cut out of the wall of the cabin. Nothing of value had been taken, so robbery did not appear to be the motive. So after authorities arrived at the scene, they really didn't section off, like, anything as a crime scene, and they had so many people coming, like, in and out of there that, like, the whole scene was heavily disturbed and damaged. So authorities ended up just, like, arresting Diane's entire staff, and then, like, a couple of weird things kind of happened in the investigation. One of the men who had been on Diane's staff as a tracker was Emmanuel Ruelcana, I hope is how you say it. So he had reportedly been fired after he tried to murder Diane with a machete. But there is literally like no evidence or witness accounts or anything to back up this story, which is weird that like that's he's being accused of something so specific. But then when he was in custody, he was found dead in his jail cell with the official report saying that he had hanged himself. So just like that whole thing doesn't make any sense. Rwandan authorities began to believe that Diane's assistant, Wayne McGuire, was her murderer. They theorized that he wanted Diane dead so that he could steal the manuscript of her second book, which was like sort of a sequel to Gorillas in the Mist. They believe that he had been unhappy with his own research work and wanted to claim credit for Diane's. So, because McGuire had returned back to the United States after her death, Rwandan courts charged him for her murder in Absidia. They found him guilty and sentenced him to death by firing squad. However, no kind of extradition agreement had been put in place between Rwanda and the United States, so he just obviously has never gone back to Rwanda. He did release a statement saying that these charges were completely outrageous and fabricated, and that Diane had been a dear friend and mentor to him. Ever since, he has stayed out of the public eye, while those that worked on site at Karasoki and those that knew Diane and Wayne McGuire really, like, don't think he killed her. They more so thought, like, authorities just used him as someone to, like, pin her murder on. But he has since kind of, like, remained a social pariah, which is why he's just kind of stayed out of the public eye. So many other theories surrounding Diane's death have come up through the years, most notably that somewhat obvious theory that Diane was killed by poachers. Diane's close friend and colleague Ian Redman has had a hard time with that theory, saying, quote, "Poachers were rural people with few means, and they did not know the camp well enough to be a threat to her." And then, like, essentially everyone that worked on the site, like, really doubted that poachers were responsible, because, like, basically poachers knew what they were doing was illegal, so they stayed under the radar as much as possible. So, like, the last thing they would have done would be to cause this huge kind of a battle and, like, bring attention to themselves. So, like, now obviously Wayne McGuire has never been officially punished for Diane's murder, and no other investigations have been ordered, so her murder officially remains unsolved. So, after her death, Diane Fossey was buried on site at Karasoki. She was buried next to her beloved gorilla Digit. Various memorial services were held in the United States to honor her life and legacy. Diane left her estate and her royalties relating to the film version of Gorillas in the Mist to the Digit Fund, which is used to further advance research and conservation efforts. Her mother was awarded $4.9 million from the will, which she said she planned on using to preserve her daughter's life's work. The Digit Fund was renamed the Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund International, which now operates the Karasoki Research Center. To this day, the center works to provide and advocate for gorilla protections and behavior monitoring. And that's the case of Diane Fossey.
Now I feel like there are books of her in the library.
There probably are. It's probably the book she wrote.
Yeah.
But yeah, I just thought that.
Yeah, that's not how I thought that story
was. No. I thought about being like, this is the story of the paleoanthropologist. But then I was like, I just want to like start it and have you be confused as to like where it's going to go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I enjoy that because I was like looking up cases and I just saw like a gorilla advocate macheted to death. And I was like, what?
Yeah, but definitely watch that Jane Goodall documentary.
Okay.
It's like fully from like within the camp and stuff. Ooh. It's really interesting. The second case I'm going to cover is the murder of Diane Harlan and the disappearance of Hugh Harlan.
I thought you were going to be like the murder of Diane Fossey. I was like, hey.
Let's hear that one more time. So Hugh Harlan was born July 31st, 1935, and was a native of Morro Bay, California. He worked as a self-employed fisherman, working when he saw fit, and spending his other time volunteering to help his neighbors out of personal fulfillment. Hugh got along well with others, was viewed by his community as an atypical, quirky person who lived their life their own way and respected others. Even though Hugh was respected in his community and seemed to be living a happy life by the sea in California, his personal life told another story. Hugh was married to Diane Harlan. Diane was known around town as the dog lady because she loved her dogs more than people. And basically same. So if they're giving her that name to be rude, dogs are better than people anyways, so case closed. But I think that they were saying it in like a negative way. They're like, oh, she...
Oh, like a crazy cat lady, blah, 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 type thing.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. And I'm like, well, she's not wrong, though. Like, dogs are better than people.
Yeah, dogs are pretty unproblematic.
Locally, Hugh and Diane were known to have a rocky relationship. It was reported that Diane would waste Hugh's money on stupid, unnecessary things and do things to purposely make her husband angry. Diane would often use Hugh's money and spend it on her dogs, her friends, and even walk around and give the money to the homeless. Aww. Diane, which I'm like, that's nice, but from Hugh's perspective, it's not her money to give away. I'm like, okay. But then it got a little weird, and it was reported that Diane would also serve Hugh dog food for dinner or bake dog food into casseroles.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, they were known around town as a quirky couple, but some of this, I'm like, okay. Yeah.
God, you guys are so quirky that you force feed it's your so husband. So
quirky that we eat dog food.
Dog food in casserole. Like, cool. So on October 13th, 1982, a badly decomposed body of a woman was found near the beach in Morro Bay, California. Near the body, a jade bracelet and a silver bracelet were found. The woman had been strangled to death with a dog leash. At first, investigators were not able to identify the body, so law enforcement released a description of her to the public for help. Someone had read the description and immediately called Hugh and urged him to go to the police because this person believed that the body was of Diane. And I'm assuming at this point, like, people knew she was missing. The body had been so badly decomposed that she had obviously been missing for a while. So after this person calls Hugh and says, hey, call the police, I'm pretty sure they found Diane, Hugh does call the police and he meets with investigators. The investigators were able to show Hugh the bracelets that were found near the body, the jade and the silver one, and Hugh identified them as belonging to his wife, Diane. Hugh told investigators that Diane had been, quote, away from home for 12 days.
Just casually away from home for like 2 weeks.
Yeah, so she's gone, but you're not going to report anything? Yeah, okay. Hugh told investigators that he was not worried about his wife's absence until he heard about a body that had been found on the beach. Because of Hugh's relationship to Diane, investigators considered him a suspect because he never reported her missing and because of reports of a rocky relationship between the two. But when Hugh suspected that he could be considered a suspect, he reassured investigators that Diane would often leave for days at a time without contacting him. So he was just trying to make it seem like this is totally normal.
Okay, this
she would totally leave for that.
Normal people don't randomly disappear for days on end without telling anyone where they're going. That's not a normal thing, especially your spouse.
Like, I would hope that. Investigators started to question Hugh more and more. When they asked Hugh about the last time he saw Diane, he claimed that though Diane hadn't returned, her dogs did, and that they had their leashes on.
That's suspicious.
So he's trying to be like, there's no way she was killed with her own dog's dog leash because the dogs came back and they had their leashes on. However, when investigators revealed to Hugh that Diane had been strangled to death with a dog leash, he abruptly changed his statement and claimed that the dogs returned home and not one of them had their leashes on. Yeah, so after Hugh changed his answer, police became more suspicious of him and Hugh refused to answer any more questions until he had an attorney present.
I'm already going to say I'm going to be annoyed. I don't understand how this is unsolved because it seems pretty open and shut to me.
Hugh claimed that the police were wrong and that Diane didn't actually die of homicide. Hugh told police he thought Diane died as a result of a brain aneurysm, which he said she had received a treatment for in the past. Though police never charged Hugh in connection with Diane's murder, he always remained a suspect. Investigators would later reveal that although they didn't think Hugh actually killed Diane, they did feel that he knew more than he was letting on and may have been concealing facts out of fear. So 4 years had passed and still there was no resolution in Diane's murder. But then on November 1st, 1986, Hugh went to a friend's house to borrow some tools for a 2-day construction job he was doing in San Simon, California, just 27 miles away from his home. He left town on the evening of November 1st and was never seen again. A few days after Hugh's disappearance, some of his friends found his pickup truck deserted on the side of the road near Cambria, California. Several of his personal possessions were found, including his glasses, a backpack, sleeping bag, and some tins containing tobacco and pot. The keys to the truck were found on the ground a few feet away, and his friends also discovered that the fuel line to the truck had been removed. Some people believe Hugh vanished because of guilt for murdering Diane or for knowing what happened to Diane and not coming forward. But Hugh's friends think he just left for other reasons.
What other reason?
Some think Hugh was hot. Yeah,
that sounds like the same excuse of like, oh, my wife just like always just will disappear for days on end and not tell me.
Yeah, I'm like, how do you just pack up your own shit and say telling everyone you're going to be gone for 2 days and then you just leave your home and
also, it sounds super convincing. Oh, no. He just disappeared for other reasons. Well, what reason? Just other reasons.
Yeah, and they're like, okay.
Not because he killed his wife. Other reasons.
Yeah. But others think that Hugh was harmed by whoever killed Diane. I'm like, okay, 4 years later, they're going to come after him for what? And then other people think that something fishy happened since Hugh's truck was left abandoned. They're like, why would you just leave your car at the side of the road if you're going to disappear forever? Just leave it at home. Like, why are you like, and why was the scene the way it was? But 39 years after the murder of Diane Harlan, the case remains unsolved with no known suspects besides Hugh. And 35 years after the disappearance of Hugh, law enforcement have no answers. And that is
the
story
hell?
Of the murder of Diane Harlan and the disappearance of her husband.
Okay, well,
Hugh.
He definitely did it.
Yeah.
Like, he definitely did.
Well, that's why, like, yeah, I'm like, they don't have any evidence besides the fact that, you know, he didn't report her missing, wasn't very concerned that she got murdered. He changed his story about the dog leashes. He was able to, like, identify her belongings. And then randomly 4 years later, he just disappears off the place of, like, literally no clues about where he
is. Right, but, like, also,
except for, like, his truck.
Why would the dog lady disappear on her own accord for days on end without her dogs? No. I will say, I am so impressed by people that, like, disappear and, like, disappear. Not, like, obviously people that are, like, people that, like, are obviously, like, disappear on their own accord. I mean, like, not people that are, like, kidnapped or whatever. That was a good one. Ugh. My second unsolved case is really well known. And it was another one that I had originally, like, 10 episodes ago, tried, like, writing and then just, like, had issues with writing it. So I, like, put it off. And then I forgot about it. And then we were like, we're going to do unsolved 80s crimes. I was like, oh, yeah, this happened in the 80s. So this is the drowning of Natalie Wood. Do you know much about this one?
I feel like I've heard of it, but I don't know if I know, like, the details.
So Natalie Wood was born Natalie... why did I include this? Natalie Zakarenko. That's probably not how you say it. On July 20th, 1938 in San Francisco, California. She was born to Russian immigrant parents, Nikolai and Maria Stepanovna Zakarenko. Oh, God. This happens every case I cover. Every case. Along with her sisters, the girls were raised Russian Orthodox and were often encouraged into the performing arts by their mother, who in her youth had dreams of becoming an actress. After a short time living in Santa Rosa, the family moved to Los Angeles in hopes Natalie could pursue a child star career. In some alternate fantasy, it is my absolute dream to be that mother with like a three-year-old that's like, come on, tap dance for him. We gotta get you in the pictures. In 1943, at 5 years old, Natalie made her film debut in the movie Happy Land. While she only appeared on screen for 15 seconds, she attracted the attention of studio executives at RKO Pictures and other notable figures in the film industry. And then around this time, she officially changed her stage name to Natalie Wood. At 7 years old, she was cast in Orson Welles' film Tomorrow, If Forever. Welles later described her acting as, quote, so good she was terrifying. Throughout the next year or so, she booked notable roles in several additional feature films. However, she is perhaps best known for her role in the 1947 classic Miracle on 34th Street. After the film's release, her career as a child star really skyrocketed, and she began to receive significant media attention. Over the next 5 years, she would appear in nearly 20 films, along with several television appearances and seasonal roles, such as on the sitcom The Pride of the Family and General Electric Theater. Now, as history has shown, a lot of child stars tend to struggle with transitioning into more mature roles. However, Natalie Wood is one of the exceptions. She effortlessly and successfully transformed into a respected adult actress, beginning at age 16 when she was cast in the role of Judy and starred alongside James Dean and Sal Mineo in the film Rebel Without a Cause. She later said that Rebel Without a Cause was the first project that she actually really wanted to do because every role she had had prior to that, like, she had basically, like, been told to take by her parents. So this film brought even more success to her career, and she received her first Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actress. In 1956, she graduated from high school and immediately signed with Warner Brothers. So the studio, like, initially began kind of, like, typecasting her in, like, the girlfriend role, and she found this, like, really unsatisfying. But on November 28th, 1957, Natalie Wood married actor Robert Wagner in Scottsdale, Arizona, which brought a lot of new media attention on Natalie because they were kind of, like, the new it couple. So eventually, the studio gave her the leading role in the 1958 film Marjorie Morningstar. As an actress, she had a wide range of acting styles, and her career continued to blossom. She was cast opposite Frank Sinatra in Kings Go Forth, but after the film's release, she began refusing more and more roles, which really upset Warner Brothers executives, which caused them to eventually suspend her for nearly a year. Once her suspension was lifted, she saw some difficulties in her career. A couple of her films were box office flops, and as she was entering her 20s, she had a hard time finding her way. With her career decline, she really wanted to prove herself to the industry and transform this perception people had of her as this, like, child star and teenage sweetheart, and she wanted to establish herself as a serious dramatic actress. So in 1961, she landed a role opposite Warren Beatty in the film Splendor in the Grass. She played a woman who suffered an emotional and psychological breakdown where she is eventually admitted to a mental hospital. Natalie Wood proved to perform with such emotional depth, talent, and maturity. She saw rave reviews from critics, industry professionals, and audiences alike. For the role, she received her second Academy Award nomination, a Golden Globe nomination, and a BAFTA nomination. Her next role would be the one most people probably remember her for. She played Maria in the 1961 classic West Side Story. This was again praised by critics and audiences and was a huge box office success. Though she was not responsible for the singing that she did, that her character did in the film, it is still considered one of her best roles. On June 20th, 1961, Natalie Wood and Robert Wagner released a joint statement announcing that the two were separating. Following the split, Natalie briefly dated her Splendor in the Grass co-star Warren Beatty, as well as Michael Caine. At the age of 25, she starred in the 1964 film Love with the Proper Stranger, which she would receive her third Academy Award nomination for. After this, she transitioned away from dramatic acting and starred in a few comedies, which again saw great success. In 1965, she became engaged to businessman Ladislav Blatnik, but the engagement ended. After the 1966 release of This Property is Condemned, which she starred alongside Robert Redford and again received a Golden Globe nomination, she paid a fee of $175,000 to Warner Brothers to get out of her contract, and then she fired her entire management team. She basically had been suffering from severe emotional turmoil and really just needed a break and professional help. So she then just took a 3-year hiatus from the entertainment industry. In 1969, she married her boyfriend of 3 years, Richard Gregson. And in 1970, they welcomed their daughter, Natasha. However, by August of 1971, Wood filed for divorce and the two separated. Soon after her divorce from Richard Gregson, Natalie reconciled with her ex-husband, fellow actor Robert Wagner, and the two remarried on July 6, 1972. The couple welcomed their only child together, Courtney Wagner, on March 9, 1974. For the remainder of the 1970s, Wood mainly only took on television roles here and there. Towards the end of the decade, she came back into the spotlight. In 1979, she starred in the miniseries From Here to Eternity, which she received critical success, and she received a Golden Globe Award for Best Actress. All right, so now that we know her career and whatnot, so now let's jump forward to the morning of November 29th, 1981. Natalie Wood's body was discovered floating in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of Catalina Island's Blue Cavern Point, about a mile away from her and her husband's private yacht. She was dressed in a flannel nightgown, wool socks, and a down jacket. Washed up on the rocks was the yacht's dinghy, the Prince Valiant. The ignition was turned off, the gear shift was in neutral, and the oars were locked, so it appeared that the vessel was never started. An autopsy was performed where it was discovered she had a blood alcohol level of 0.14, which is nearly double the legal limit. The coroner found she had bruisings all over her arms and over her legs, and she had a cut on her cheek. These injuries were thought to be attributed to her falling into the water, and her death was ruled as an accidental drowning. So, Natalie had been in the area filming the science fiction film Brainstorm alongside actor Christopher Walken. Her husband, Robert Wagner, had decided to spend the weekend with her on their yacht, the Splendor, and the couple invited Walken to join them. The couple's longtime friend, Dennis Davern, was hired to serve as their captain. It's been rumored that Natalie was, like, somewhat infatuated with Christopher Walken, which was why Robert Wagner came into town for the weekend, but, like, that's mostly speculative. So the group boarded the yacht at noon on Friday, November 27th, and then they spent most of the day drinking together. That evening, Wood and Wagner got into a fight, which reportedly escalated to a concerning point that Davern asked Walken to break it up, but he refused, basically saying he didn't want to get involved in a couple's argument. So eventually, Davern took Natalie ashore, where they booked a room at the Pavilion Launch Hotel. Davern was really protective of Natalie, and he considered her to be a dear friend, so while they shared a hotel room, it's not thought that they had any kind of, like, romantic relationship. So the next morning, so now it's Saturday, November 28th, Davern returned with Natalie back to the yacht. Things seemed to have cooled off to an extent, so that afternoon, Natalie and Christopher Walken went ashore and headed to Doug's Harbor Reef Restaurant, where Davern and Wagner later joined them. A waitress later told investigators that during the dinner, the group drank multiple bottles of wine, multiple bottles of champagne, and ordered multiple mixed cocktails. Natalie did not eat much of her dinner and seemed to be upset about something. When the group left the restaurant, Natalie appeared to stumble a bit and had kind of a hard time walking. Now, Davern would also later claim that Natalie and Christopher Walken were fairly flirtatious with each other throughout the dinner. So after they left the restaurant, the group returned to the yacht for the night around 10 p.m. And as they boarded the yacht, a waitress had heard Natalie yell something, but she just kind of played it off as nothing since, like, Natalie appeared to be intoxicated. Once the group was back on the yacht for the evening, Natalie and Robert Wagner got into a non-violent argument. But up until this point in, like, the story, I guess, all accounts of the events leading up to the discovery of her body have been pretty consistent with one another. But now we're getting to the point in the story where inconsistencies kind of start. So Robert Wagner said that the fight that had happened was between him and Christopher Walken. He said that he and Walken had just gotten into a political debate that began at dinner and had continued after they boarded the yacht. He said after a while, Natalie got bored of their debate and presumably went to bed, and he and Walken's conversation continued for another hour or so. I'm going to point out that Davern tends to be considered somewhat of an unreliable witness, mostly because his claims have been made years later and it's often in tabloids, but his claims also line up with other witness claims and evidence pretty well. So Davern claimed that Wagner started a fight with Christopher Walken where he smashed a bottle of wine and accused Walken of wanting to sleep with Natalie. Now, Wagner did later admit in his 2009 memoir to smashing a wine bottle that night. So then we have Christopher Walken's account of events. So he stated that Natalie and Robert Wagner had gotten into an argument over Natalie's time spent away from their family. He said that initially he started to defend Natalie but then stepped outside because he didn't want to get involved in their personal matters. When he returned, the couple had made up. Davern's account also lined up with this, but he additionally stated that the couple reignited their argument later on in the evening. So after Wagner and Walken ended their conversation, Walken retired to his bedroom for the night. Wagner claims that he went to the couple's bedroom to kiss Natalie goodnight and noticed she was not in their bedroom. That's when he noticed their dinghy, the Valiant, was missing. So around 11:30 p.m., Wagner went to Davern and he had looked, quote, tussled and sweating profusely as if he had been in a terrible fight or ordeal of some kind, end quote. Wagner then told Davern that Natalie went off the boat and they need to look for her. Wagner told Davern not to turn on the yacht's floodlights or start the engine because he didn't want to gather attention from people nearby. Davern has since stated that he always had a feeling something bad had happened to Natalie because he was certain that she would not have tried to go ashore by herself, especially because she was, like, well known to have an extreme fear of water and a fear of drowning. So at 1:30 a.m., Davern made a distress call to the Coast Guard stating that Natalie had disappeared from the yacht, and then, as we know, her body was discovered a few hours later. So now that we have a sense of, like, what happened, let's discuss the theory that she fell into the water and accidentally drowned. So, LA County Chief Medical Examiner Thomas Noguchi believed that she had fallen into the water as she tried to board the dinghy, the Valiant. He theorized that her down jacket became heavy as it got wet and weighed her down. That factor, along with her blood alcohol level, caused some level of confusion, so she didn't think to take off the jacket. So fingernail scratches were found on the side of the Valiant, which officials believe showed evidence that she tried to climb back on board. Eventually, it's thought she finally drowned due to hypothermia from the water's cold temperatures, as well as from exhaustion. Regarding this theory, Natalie's sister Lana Wood said, quote, "My sister was not a swimmer. She did not know how to swim, and she would never go to another boat or to shore dressed in a nightgown and socks." Robert Wagner also stated in his biography, quote, "It was only after I was told that she was dressed in a sleeping gown, heavy socks, and a parka that it dawned on me what had really occurred." Natalie obviously had trouble with that dinghy slamming up against the boat. It happened many, many times before, and I had always gone out and pulled the ropes tighter to keep the dinghy flush against the yacht. She probably skidded on one of the steps after untying the ropes. The steps are slick as ice because of the algae and seaweed that's always clinging to them. After slipping on the steps, she hit her head against the boat. I only hope she was unconscious when she hit the water. It's just a very specific...
Yeah, I'd be like, this is definitely what happened.
So, some people have a problem with this theory because the Valiant was a rubber dinghy. So, it would not have made a lot of noise if it slammed against the yacht. Also, investigators had found that the algae on the steps was untouched, which could indicate Natalie had tried to board the dinghy and not, like, adjusted the rope. So they also found broken glass on the deck of the yacht, which Robert Wagner claimed had happened because of the rough waters. So essentially, nothing really came of the investigation, and then the case went unsolved for decades. But in 2011, LA County officials reopened the case into her death based on new information. In 2012, the LA County Coroner's Office officially changed her cause of death from accidental drowning to drowning and other undetermined factors. So these new factors in the investigation just like kind of bring more doubt into the nature of the bruises and the cuts found in her body, posing the possibility that they'd happened before she fell into the water. In 2012, the chief medical examiner reported, quote, "The location of the bruises, the multiplicity of the bruises, lack of head trauma or facial bruising support bruising having occurred prior to entry in the water. Since there are unanswered questions and limited additional evidence available for evaluation, it is opinioned by this medical examiner that the manner of death should be left as undetermined." So in 2013, the LA County Sheriff's Department said that the investigation was open and ongoing and nothing definitive has closed it. However, they did say that Robert Wagner was not being considered a suspect in Natalie's death. Natalie's sister has since stated publicly that while she can't imagine Robert would have purposely done anything to hurt or bring harm to Natalie, she did say, quote, "I know things happen when there's too much drinking and fighting." For his part, Robert Wagner has claimed responsibility in that he did not notice Natalie was gone from the boat sooner. While Christopher Walken has not often spoken publicly about the case, he has said, quote, "The people who are convinced that there was something more to it than what came out in the investigation will never be satisfied with the truth. Because the truth is, there is nothing more to it. It was an accident." As of 2021, the case still remains open and unsolved. And on that note, a former lead police investigator on the case still to this day says, quote, "I can't tell you exactly how Natalie Wood got into the water."
Yeah, because if that was like, you know, a yacht in today's standards, there would be cameras everywhere. There would be so many mechanisms and things to ensure something like that doesn't happen.
Yeah,
if it was an accident. Yeah,
I feel Robert Wagner did it. If he didn't do, like, if he, not necessarily he did it on purpose, but there's like a lot more you can obviously read into like the evidence and the inconsistencies and things. But yeah, I think he at least for sure think he has not said certain things to investigators.
Yeah, like he knows
more than he's saying, or he has more knowledge than he's leading on. But yeah, and Christopher Walken's obviously still alive. He's still alive, and so is the captain. So I'm not holding my breath that anyone's going to get arrested or anything, but maybe we'll get a deathbed confession. I hate them, but...
Yeah. Good point.
You never know. All right, well, thank you guys for listening to the very last final episode.
We really appreciate all of the listens over the last almost 6 months.
Really? Are we been doing this for 6 months?
Almost, yeah.
Gross. It feels like that long, but like also doesn't feel like that long. Also feels longer. What is time? But seriously, though, thank you to everyone that has supported us, has listened, has left us a review, has shared things on social media.
Good bonding for you and I.
We were without our arguments either.
You and me, however.
But yeah, thank you guys for listening. Like I said, who knows? We could be back at some point. But for now, we got to say bye. You can still follow us on Facebook and Instagram if you would like, at the Serial Sisters Pod. Twitter at Serial Sis Pod. And for the final time, we will bid you adieu. We will say sayonara.
And au revoir.
Au revoir.
Ciao.
Ciao.
Adios.
Arrivederci. Bye. Sisters.